We would like to send out a special thanks to the fun and challenging Best Fiends for sponsoring The Trail Went Cold. Best Fiends is the binge-worthy mobile puzzle game. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you and enjoy the episode.
July 19, 1996, West Wego, Louisiana. After leaving her apartment to walk to a supermarket, 14-year-old Crystal Champagne fails to return and is found strangled to death in a wooded area the following evening. When Crystal's 22-year-old step-cousin, Damon Thibodeau, is interrogated by police, he confesses to her murder and is subsequently convicted and sentenced to death. However, Damon maintains that his confession was coerced and none of the physical evidence from the crime matches him. After serving 16 years, Damon's conviction is vacated and he is released from death row. But Crystal's real killer is never found. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a crime which led to a wrongful conviction, the 1996 murder of Crystal Champagne. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Anne King, the latest winner of our Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Anne. This is a monthly contest which we've been holding for 4 years now, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, Crystal Champagne was a 14-year-old girl who went missing and was found strangled to death, and almost immediately after the discovery of her body, her step-cousin, Damon Thibodeau, confessed to the crime and was subsequently charged and sentenced to death for her murder. Damon would spend 16 years behind bars, but unfortunately, it turned out that his confession was coerced, and since none of the physical evidence matched him, his conviction was eventually overturned and he was released. This story was once featured on an episode of the true crime show 48 Hours, and I've been meaning to cover it on my podcast for a while, but I decided to insert it into my schedule this month because of some tragic news, as Damon Thibodeau recently passed away due to complications from COVID-19. While it's good that Damon was exonerated before his death, the actual murder victim in this case, Crystal Champagne, has still never received justice. So on this episode, we're not only going to explore what went wrong in this case, but also try to figure out who the real perpetrator might have been. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the murder of Crystal Champagne. Our story begins in 1996 in West Wego, Louisiana, a suburban community of New Orleans which lies along the west bank of the Mississippi River. Our central figure is 14-year-old Crystal Marie Champagne, who lives at the Tanglewood Apartments complex with her parents, CJ and Don Champagne. At around 5:15 p.m. on July the 19th, Crystal left her apartment in order to walk to a nearby Winn-Dixie supermarket to purchase some noodles, but when she failed to return after an hour had passed, her family went out and started searching for her. Crystal could not be found, so her mother reported her missing to the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office. Over the course of the next 24 hours, a number of people would canvass the area with missing persons flyers for Crystal, and witnesses would recall having seen her at the Winn-Dixie supermarket on the night she disappeared. Finally, at around 7:40 p.m., a family friend and neighbor named Stacy Melanson called the police from a payphone in the unincorporated community of Bridge City to inform them that Crystal had been found dead. Stacy claimed that she and her boyfriend, John Tomlinson, had shown Crystal's flyer to a pair of women at a convenience store in Bridge City, who told them they recalled seeing a girl matching Crystal's description walking down the levee next to the Mississippi River the previous evening. When Stacy and John went to the area, they soon discovered Crystal's body in a wooded area located underneath the Huey P. Long Bridge. The location was about 5 miles from Crystal's apartment, and an autopsy would reveal that she had been strangled to death and beaten with a blunt object, as she had a fractured skull, a missing tooth, and hemorrhaging to her right eye and forehead. A red industrial wire which had likely been used to strangle Crystal was found tied to a nearby tree. Since her shirt was pulled up over her breasts, and her shorts and underwear were pulled down, it appeared that Crystal had also been the victim of a sexual assault. It would later be estimated that Crystal had been dead around 24 hours before she was found, placing her approximate time of death at sometime between 7 and 8 p.m. on July the 19th. Before Crystal's body was discovered, investigators from the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office had been interviewing a number of her friends and family members, including her 22-year-old step-cousin Damon Thibodeau, whose mother was once married to Crystal's uncle. Damon had been living in Midland, Texas, but weeks earlier, after traveling to New Orleans to attend his sister's wedding, he decided he wanted to remain in the area to be closer to his family. He moved in with his mother and got a job as an offshore deckhand on a Mississippi River barge. Even though the Champagne family didn't know Damon all that well, they quickly befriended him, and on the night before Crystal went missing, he went out drinking with Don and CJ and stayed over at their apartment. Damon was still there when Crystal left to go to the supermarket the following day, and in fact, she had even asked Damon to give her a ride, but he declined because he was busy fixing a watch. Damon actively participated in the search effort for Crystal before he returned to his mother's house on the evening of July the 20th. Shortly after he arrived, investigators showed up there in order to question Damon, and he agreed to accompany them to the police station for an interview. However, shortly after the questioning started, investigators were informed that Crystal's body had been found, and they started focusing on Damon as a potential suspect. Even though Damon had 2 previous marijuana possession charges on his record, he didn't have any known history of violence, and Crystal's family would later say they never saw any warning signs of him being inappropriate with her. In spite of this, police would spend the next 9 hours interrogating Damon without any legal counsel present. At one point, Damon agreed to take a polygraph test, but was informed that the results showed signs of deception. Even though Damon provided the names of all the people he had been with during the past 24 hours and could function as his alibi witnesses, the detectives lied to him by stating these witnesses had already disputed his alibi. They told Damon they had evidence he killed Crystal, and even planted the idea into his head that he may have blacked out and committed the crime without even remembering it. The interrogation continued on till the early morning hours of July the 21st, and at 4:21 a.m., Damon finally confessed to Crystal's murder, stating, quote, "I didn't know that I had done it, but I done it." He claimed that he had picked up Crystal in his car after she left the supermarket and proceeded to drive her to the levee under the Huey P. Long Bridge. They began to have sex until Crystal yelled out, "Ouch, it hurts, take it easy." When she resisted, Damon claimed this caused him to snap, and he proceeded to rape and beat Crystal before strangling her to death. Afterwards, he returned to Crystal's apartment and assisted with the search effort. Damon was subsequently charged with first-degree murder and aggravated rape, and was so exhausted by this point that he passed out while being transported to jail. However, once Damon woke up, he realized the full ramifications of what happened and immediately recanted his confession. By the time the interrogation started, Damon had gotten virtually no sleep during the past 35 hours, and he started to lose all sense of reality. He claimed that at one point, the detectives threatened him with the death penalty and went into graphic detail about how painful it would be for him to die by a lethal injection. They told Damon that he might receive leniency if he confessed, so he finally decided to tell them what they wanted to hear in order to make the whole ordeal stop. Indeed, it turned out there were a lot of issues with the confession, as only 54 minutes of the 9-hour interrogation session were recorded, and Damon got a number of details wrong about the crime. For starters, Damon claimed that before he strangled Crystal with a wire, he had first choked her with his bare hands, but there were no injuries on her throat to suggest that. But while it seemed clear that the red wire found tied to a nearby tree was the murder weapon, Damon said that he had used a clear black or gray speaker wire, which he had gotten from the trunk of his car. In fact, one of the detectives had even followed up this statement by asking Damon if he had any red wire inside his vehicle. Even though the severe injuries to Crystal's face indicated that she had been bludgeoned by a blunt object, Damon only mentioned hitting her with his fists, and while he said that Crystal's body was face down when he left the scene, she was actually found face up. The most troubling inconsistency was that Damon had confessed to raping Crystal, and specifically mentioned ejaculating as he squeezed Crystal's throat, but there was no trace of semen found in or on her body. In fact, even though Crystal's shirt had been pulled up, and her shorts pulled down, it did not appear she was raped at all. Forensic testing would be performed on 86 pieces of physical evidence, but nothing could be found to link Damon to the crime, and while hairs and fibers were taken from Damon's car, none of them matched Crystal. Regardless, Damon would still go on trial for the crime in September of 1997, and the case was prosecuted by Jefferson Parish District Attorney Paul Connick Jr. In spite of the lack of physical evidence against Damon, a detective would attempt to account for this by testifying that there was significant maggot activity on Crystal's body at the time she was found, so the maggots could have consumed all the seminal fluids Damon left behind. In addition to Damon's confession, corroborating evidence was presented by two eyewitnesses who testified that on the night of the crime, they had seen a man matching Damon's description nervously pacing on the levee near the spot where Crystal's body was found. Police later showed them a photo lineup, and they both identified Damon as the man they saw. There was some question about whether Damon would have had the opportunity to kill Crystal that night, as it would have taken between 10 to 15 minutes to drive from Crystal's apartment in Westwego to the murder scene in Bridge City. Throughout the course of the evening, Damon was almost always in the company of other people who could vouch for his whereabouts, aside from a period of around 30 to 45 minutes when Damon claimed he was sitting alone in his parked car, smoking a joint. In her original statement to police, Dawn Champagne said that Damon was with her inside the apartment at 7:30 p.m. when she made the call to report Crystal missing. Since Crystal's time of death was estimated to have been sometime between 7 and 8 o'clock that night, this could have cleared Damon of any involvement. But when Dawn took the stand to testify at the trial, she now claimed that Damon was not with her when she phoned the police. The case went to the jury on October the 3rd, and after deliberating for only 1 hour, they found Damon guilty of Crystal's aggravated rape and first-degree murder. Since the aggravating circumstances made Damon eligible for the death penalty, he was sentenced to be executed via lethal injection. After Damon was sent to death row at the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola, the controversial nature of his case eventually led to him being represented by a number of advocacy organizations, including the Innocence Project, the Capital Post-Conviction Project of Louisiana, and a Minneapolis-based law firm called Fredrickson and Byron. A number of unsuccessful appeals were filed to overturn Damon's conviction, but it kept getting affirmed by the Louisiana Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court. In May of 2007, Damon's legal team decided to approach Jefferson County District Attorney Paul Connick Jr. with the idea of launching a joint reinvestigation into the case in which both sides would split the costs. Surprisingly, Connick agreed to work with them, so a lot of the evidence was re-examined. New DNA testing was performed on the clothing that Crystal and Damon had worn on the night of the crime. The results showed no trace of Damon's DNA on Crystal's clothing, and vice versa. A tiny sample of blood had been found on the red wire used to strangle Crystal, and while testing revealed that the blood had a male DNA profile, it did not match Damon. The two eyewitnesses who had reported seeing Damon pacing on the levee on the night of the crime were re-interviewed, and they made some surprising admissions. Even though they both identified Damon from a photo lineup, they now said that they had previously seen Damon's photo in the newspaper after he was charged with the murder, which likely gave them cognitive bias when they made the identification. However, what was particularly surprising is that the witnesses specifically mentioned seeing police tape at the scene when they saw this man, which would have meant that their sighting took place on the evening of July the 20th when Crystal's body was found, not on the 19th when he was murdered. And since Damon was already in police custody at this time, then the man they saw at the levee could not have been him. In addition, Dawn Champagne was also re-interviewed about her conflicting statements about whether Damon was still present at the apartment when she made the call to report Crystal missing, and she responded that her original statement to police about Damon being there was her best recollection. At the trial, testimony was provided by the state pathologist Dr. Fraser McKenzie, who outlined the details of Crystal's murder. Dr. McKenzie claimed that he was aware that Damon had confessed to the crime, but he was never shown the actual contents of the confession. When McKenzie finally saw it years later and learned that Damon had confessed to raping Crystal, he was left aghast because none of the physical evidence he saw matched the confession, so he provided a signed affidavit to Damon's legal team outlining all these discrepancies. Damon's defense team also brought in a psychologist to examine him and analyze his confession. It turned out that Damon had a very troubled childhood in which he was physically and sexually abused by multiple individuals. The psychologists conclude that Damon's abusive upbringing had caused him to grow up with a natural fear of authority figures, which made him a lot more susceptible to confessing to something he did not do. Paul Connick Jr. countered by bringing in his own forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Michael Wellner, to analyze Damon's confession. Dr. Wellner had a history of siding with law enforcement and did not believe that the confession was coerced by police, though he did conclude that it was false. Like many others, Wellner was troubled by the fact that no physical evidence linked Damon to the crime, and theorized that he may have confessed due to massive guilt over the fact that he had turned down Crystal's request to give her a ride to the supermarket on the day she was killed. Even though it was common practice for offenders to minimize their involvement whenever they admitted to a crime, Damon did the exact opposite by confessing to a rape which never actually happened. Wellner found this to be a strong indicator that Damon's confession was false, and his analysis, along with the DNA testing and the other discredited evidence, finally convinced Connick that the wrong person had been sent to prison. Connick and Damon's defense team filed a joint motion to drop the indictment against him, prompting a judge to vacate Damon's conviction. On September the 28th, 2012, after 16 years of incarceration, Damon was finally released from death row and became a free man. This turned out to be a significant milestone, as Damon officially became the 300th wrongly convicted individual in the United States to be exonerated by DNA testing. Following his release, Damon moved to Minnesota and began working at Fredrickson and Byron, the law firm who represented him, and having never graduated high school, Damon finally decided to obtain his GED. At the time he was arrested, Damon had a 5-year-old son named Josh, though they had not been in contact since Damon broke up with Josh's mother years earlier. While he was incarcerated, Damon wrote a letter to Josh, who was living in Alabama at this time, but even though they continued to correspond and started building up a relationship, Damon would not allow his son to visit him on death row, and they would not have their first in-person meeting until the day Damon walked out of prison. While making his living as a long-haul trucker, Damon became an active speaker for wrongful conviction reform, and once stated in an interview, quote, "The best part of my day, no matter how good the rest of my day is when I wake up every morning and I don't see those bars," end quote. He eventually moved to Jacksonville, Florida, but unfortunately, on August the 31st, 2021, Damon would succumb to complications from COVID-19 and died at the age of 47. Even though the investigation into the murder of Crystal Champagne was reopened following Damon's release, there does not seem to have been much progress at finding a resolution, and the identity of Crystal's real killer remains unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Best Fiends. Summer is finally over, and we are entering autumn, but before you know it, winter will be here, and at least up here in Canada, that will mean a lot of cold weather and less motivation to go outside. However, if you feel like staying indoors and avoiding the cold, that's a good opportunity to pick up a new hobby, or spend more time focusing on some of your current hobbies, which, in my case, includes the super fun Match 3 mobile puzzle game, Best Fiends. I am just about to reach the 2-year anniversary of when I originally started Best Fiends, and even after all that time, it still feels incredibly fresh. Best Fiends has thousands of puzzles, and they're constantly adding new ones all the time, which can make the game really hard to put down. I've just recently passed the magic milestone of beating level 2000, and I have no intention of stopping anytime soon. Since Best Fiends is free to download, you can start solving puzzles right away, and there are tons of cute characters, aka fiends, to collect as you go along. Last time, I mentioned that my personal favorite fiend is probably Beebert the Bumblebee, because he's a movie buff just like myself, and, well, I've been looking for any opportunity to say the name Beebert the Bumblebee on this podcast. No matter what the season, if you find yourself unplugging from the internet to hit reset, or just finding yourself without Wi-Fi, you can still enjoy Best Fiends. You can play it literally anywhere without having to worry about Wi-Fi or using data, so if you don't have the internet for whatever reason, you never have to miss out on any of the thousands of fun puzzles Best Fiends has to offer. So to download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play, that's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Give it a try. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. Of course, wrongful convictions are incredibly sad stories to cover, because not only does an innocent person have to serve years in prison for a crime they did not commit, but a lot of the time, the actual victim of the crime never receives justice. Whenever someone goes through the ordeal of being wrongfully convicted and has many years of their life stolen away, I always hope that they receive the opportunity to live the best life possible once they are released from prison, so it's incredibly tragic when they do not get to live much longer. In spite of what he endured, Damon Thibodeau was only 38 years old when he was released from death row and still had many years ahead of him. Prior to his arrest, Damon had already endured a very difficult, abusive childhood, but it sounds like he was attempting to live the best life possible these past 9 years before he succumbed to COVID-19. The Innocence Project referred to Damon as an incredibly kind and gentle person during his obituary, and he was attempting to use his experience behind bars to do good. Damon was particularly outspoken against the practice of solitary confinement, deeming it to be cruel and unusual punishment. During his time on death row, Damon would spend 23 hours per day in a small cell, and even after his release, he wound up suffering from frequent nightmares because of the experience, and initially had trouble adjusting to the outside world. At one point, Damon testified in a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee hearing on human rights, and admitted that the experience was so torturous that there were times he just wanted the execution to move forward rather than fight for his exoneration. He stated, quote, "I did not want to live like an animal in a cage for years on end, only to lose my case and then have the state kill me anyway. I thought it would be better to end my life as soon as I could and avoid the agony of life in solitary," end quote. Unfortunately, Damon never received any compensation for his wrongful conviction because even though all the evidence against him was discredited, the Louisiana Attorney General's office stated that he would need to prove his factual innocence. So even though there was no trace of Damon's DNA found on the victim or anywhere near the murder scene, it's not like they could perform DNA testing on a definitive piece of evidence like a semen sample to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that he did not commit this crime. Damon did attempt to file a federal civil rights lawsuit, which was put on hold in 2017, and this claim was still pending at the time of his death. One of the main reasons wrongful convictions happen is that when police are facing a lot of public pressure to solve a crime and focus on a promising suspect, they'll often develop tunnel vision and do everything in their power to make the case fit that person, even if the evidence leans away from them. But in the case of Crystal Champagne's murder, there wasn't even time for public pressure, since Damon was charged within hours of her body being found. But the problem is that Damon was already in custody for what should have been a routine interview, and once everything evolved from a missing persons case to a homicide investigation, investigators decided to pin the crime on him, even though there was really no evidence, other than the fact that he happened to be present at Crystal's apartment at the time she went missing. This seemed like a case of making a suspect confess, and then worrying about finding the proper evidence after the fact. It seems insane that even with such a weak case against Damon, the jury only deliberated for an hour before they found him guilty, but confessions, no matter how unreliable they may be, still seem to hold a lot of power with jurors who have a hard time grasping the idea that anyone would confess to a crime they didn't commit. As the years go by, the public is becoming more educated on the issues of false confessions, but that still wasn't a particularly well-known issue back in 1996. In Damon's case, he had gotten virtually no sleep after Crystal disappeared, and was utterly exhausted by the time he was brought in for questioning, and after being badgered for 9 hours, Damon said he got to the point where he felt the interrogation was never going to end unless he told the police what they wanted to hear. I think that many people who make false confessions assume that everything will eventually be straightened out once the evidence showed they couldn't have committed the crime. But in most of these cases, once the suspect is charged with murder, there's no turning back. Another issue with Damon's trial is that his representation was a public defender who happened to be a former police detective and had never tried a murder case before. Damon did not know this at the time, but his public defender was actually in the midst of arranging a transfer to the district attorney's office, and well, you can't exactly rely on someone like that to provide you with the best defense. On the other side of the coin, one thing which really stands out about this case is the fact that the prosecutor who put Damon away, Jefferson Parish District Attorney Paul Connick Jr., he actually worked with Damon's legal team to help get his conviction overturned, and had no qualms about dropping the charges once it became apparent to him that Damon was innocent. As sad as this is to say, it is extraordinarily rare for prosecutors to admit they made a mistake and put the wrong person in prison, as they will often double down and stick to their guns, even when faced with overwhelming evidence. To make a comparison, you might recall the episode I released over 2 years ago about the wrongful conviction of 16-year-old Sharif Cousin, who was sentenced to death for a murder which took place in the French Quarter of New Orleans and spent nearly 3 years on death row before his conviction was overturned. That case featured some particularly egregious misconduct from the Orleans Parish District Attorney's Office, and the district attorney at that time was Harry Connick Sr., who had a long, checkered history of wrongful convictions and sending innocent people to death row. So I may have said some not-so-flattering things about him during that episode. Well, as you might have already guessed, Harry Connick Sr. is the father of famous jazz singer-slash-actor Harry Connick Jr., and Paul Connick Jr. happens to be Harry Sr.'s nephew. But remarkably, Paul seems to have a much different attitude about justice than his uncle. To be fair, even though he presided over Damon's trial, Connick did not actually get elected to the position of district attorney until 6 months after Damon's arrest, so he was not responsible for railroading him and genuinely believed he was doing the right thing at the time. Many prosecutors are unwilling to admit to their mistakes for fear that it will damage their career, but here we are in 2021, and Connick has been re-elected several times and is now entering his 24th year as Jefferson Parish district attorney. So I'm taking this as a hopeful sign that honesty does pay off sometimes. But even though Connick was willing to admit the error of his ways, it appears the same cannot be said about the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office, who continued to stick to their original case and insist they had the right man, even after Damon was released from prison. I will say that the rationale that Damon did rape Crystal and the maggots consumed all of his seminal fluids before her body was found is one of the most laughably absurd things I've ever heard in a wrongful conviction case. When the British newspaper The Guardian published an article about the case, they perfectly summed up the situation with this sentence, quote, "Unless there be any remaining doubt, a forensic expert on maggots, such people do exist, testified that the theory of semen-destroying maggots was balderdash," end quote. So like I mentioned earlier, one of the biggest tragedies of wrongful conviction cases is that there's often so much focus on the person who was unjustly sent to prison that the actual victim of the crime is overlooked. Damon Thibodeau's story has been well documented, but there's really not all that much information out there about Crystal Champagne and her life. All I know is that everyone who knew Crystal described her as a good kid, and it seems like she just happened to cross paths with the wrong person on what should have been a routine trip to the supermarket. I get the impression that after Damon was charged with Crystal's murder, her parents, Don and CJ, were convinced that he did it, even though there was a good chance Damon was actually at their apartment at the exact time Crystal was killed, and the timeline would have made it impossible for him to commit the crime. This case was featured on 48 Hours in March of 2014, and it featured interviews with Dawn, who was still emotionally distraught about the loss of her daughter, but it's unclear if she changed her mind about Damon's guilt after his conviction was overturned. It sounds like witnesses recalled seeing Crystal at the Winn-Dixie supermarket on the night she was killed, so she likely crossed paths with her killer after she left. And since Crystal was found in Bridge City, which is 5 miles away, it's reasonable to assume that she was taken to the location in a vehicle, but was she forcibly abducted, or did she climb inside the vehicle of her own volition? Could she have been offered a ride by someone she knew and trusted? It's interesting how Crystal's body was partially nude, as her shirt was pulled up and her shorts and underwear were pulled down, but the perpetrator never actually went through the act of raping her. Something obviously drove them into a violent rage, since they severely beat Crystal before strangling her, though it is odd that they would leave the murder weapon, the red industrial wire, tied to a tree at the scene. Now, because Damon was charged with the crime so quickly after Crystal's body was discovered, police never really performed a thorough investigation into other potential suspects, but there were apparently multiple individuals who lived in the area who seemed like more likely candidates to have committed a crime like this. There aren't many specific details about these individuals, but there was apparently one relative of Crystal's who lived in an apartment 2 blocks from the crime scene, and he was a paranoid schizophrenic with a history of drug abuse and violence against women. Crystal also had friends in Bridge City, and one of them would later go on to receive a life sentence in prison for the aggravated rape of a juvenile. However, the one alternate suspect who has risen the most eyebrows is the person who found Crystal's body, John Tomlinson. I already mentioned Tomlinson's name near the beginning of this episode, but here's some more backstory. At the time, he was the boyfriend of Stacy Melanson, the family friend and neighbor who called the police to report the discovery of Crystal's body. And John also lived in the same apartment complex as the Champagne family. On July the 18th, Stacy had actually gone out drinking with Damon, Dawn, and CJ, and paid Crystal to spend the night babysitting her children. Stacy then brought Crystal home at 2 p.m. the following afternoon, just over 3 hours before she left to go to the supermarket. Sometime between 5:30 and 6 p.m. on July the 20th, while Crystal was still missing, Stacy picked John Tomlinson up at a shipyard as he worked as a deckhand on a tugboat. They proceeded to continue searching for Crystal by handing out missing persons flyers, and when they stopped at a Circle K convenience store in Bridge City, 2 eyewitnesses recognized Crystal from her flyer and told them that they had seen her walking along the levee next to the Mississippi River the previous night. But here's where things get odd. It was John's idea to drive Stacy to the levee to search for Crystal, but even though the witnesses said they had seen her about a mile away from the Huey P. Long Bridge, John drove directly to the wooded area underneath the bridge. He told Stacy to wait in the car while he performed his search, and after walking down a path into the wooded area, John soon discovered Crystal's body. Now, the main reason we know all this information about John is because he agreed to be interviewed on the aforementioned 48 Hours episode, where he said that he had a unique ability to dream things which came true. John claimed that he once had a vivid dream where he found Crystal's body and looked up to see the Huey P. Long Bridge above him, which is why he felt compelled to stop the car and search for her body in the wooded area underneath the bridge. Of course, at the time this happened, John never told police about the so-called dream, instead telling them it was his quote-unquote intuition which helped him discover Crystal's body. To their credit, police did find the statement to be suspicious, so John was taken to the station and interrogated for hours. The problem? Damon was being interrogated right down the hallway at the exact same time, and when he confessed to Crystal's murder, John was no longer the focus of the investigation. Okay, so on the basis of his interview on 48 Hours, John Tomlinson definitely comes across as an odd individual. There are numerous documented cases where a murder victim's body wound up being discovered by their killer, which they sometimes do because they believe it will help take the suspicion off themselves. But this case is particularly troubling because the eyewitnesses who reported seeing Crystal placed her on the levee about a mile away from the location her body was found, yet John did not even bother to search that area and instead drove straight to the wooded area. Her body was pretty well concealed, and there's no way anyone could have seen it from the levee, unless they made a calculated decision to walk down a path into the trees, which John decided to do. He otherwise should have had no reason to believe Crystal was there, except that he was supposedly following the whims of a dream. This is a big enough red flag, but what's even more disturbing is that unlike Damon, John was a documented sex offender, as 2 years before Crystal's murder, he served time in prison after being convicted of indecent behavior with a juvenile. Now, during his 48 hours interview, John explained this by claiming that he had sexual contact with a girl he picked up at a bar whom he believed was 18, but he did not realize she was actually 14. But given that Crystal was 14 at the time of her death, this might suggest a pattern of predatory behavior. Since the Champagne family was close friends with John's girlfriend and he lived in the same apartment complex, John certainly would have known who Crystal was, and it's reasonable to assume that she might have trusted John enough to climb into a vehicle with him. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that John murdered Crystal, but if he was the killer, it's pretty mind-blowing that he was being interrogated at the exact same time as Damon, and they may have wound up charging the wrong person. John even admitted that the police pushed him pretty hard during his interrogation, so it's possible he could have eventually cracked and confessed to the crime. For all we know, Damon may have unknowingly let the real perpetrator off the hook by making his own confession. I certainly don't blame the police for looking at both men as potential suspects, but considering that there was zero evidence against Damon, you'd think they would have focused more attention on the guy who actually found the victim's body and could not come up with a logical explanation to account for it. However, before we bring the hammer down on Tomlinson, we have to acknowledge that he did have an alibi for the time period when Crystal was murdered, which is why he was not investigated any further by police. I mentioned earlier that John worked as a deckhand on a tugboat, which was cruising down the Mississippi River on the night of the crime. The boat's log showed that John was on board, and he said he was sleeping when Stacy called to inform him that Crystal was missing. But there's been some question about how reliable these logs are, because by John's own admission, it wasn't uncommon for crew members to sneak off the boat without their supervisor's knowledge and to cover for each other all the time. So theoretically, a crew member could have left the boat while it was docked and snuck back on without anyone noticing. It's interesting how Tomlinson seems to contradict himself while discussing this topic during his 48 hours interview. At one point, Aaron Moriarty asks, quote, "Now at the time, though, you told him that it was impossible to get off the boat, and it wasn't it?" End quote. Tomlinson then replies, quote, "Well, sure, you know, I mean, no, it's not. It never is, you know, but I always let my boss know when I was getting off that boat." End quote. However, later on, Moriarty asked John if he ever snuck off the boat to see Stacy, and he confirms that he did so on a few occasions and would spend the night with Stacy instead of sleeping on the boat like he was supposed to. But this admission seems to fly in sharp contrast to his previous claim that he always let his boss know whenever he got off the boat. Of course, John denies that he snuck off the boat at any point on the evening of July the 19th, 1996, and if he is telling the truth, then he can be ruled out as having any involvement in Crystal's murder. While we know that Crystal left her apartment at 5:15 p.m. and was likely killed sometime between 7 and 8 o'clock, we don't have any specific details about the exact whereabouts of the tugboat during this time period. So for all we know, it may have actually been impossible for John to have committed this crime. Even if he sneaked off the boat and killed Crystal, he still would have had to sneak back on at some point if Stacy called him on the boat that night to let him know Crystal was missing. Also, since Crystal was found 5 miles from the location where she was last seen, she probably would have needed someone with a vehicle to transport her there, and it's unclear if John would have had access to a vehicle at that time. Given the circumstances, it's possible that the logistics just made it too difficult for John to commit this crime, but the issue is that since Damon was charged with the murder so quickly, John never got the thorough investigation he deserved. Now, at the time the 48 Hours episode was filmed, John was living in the small town of Ball, Louisiana, which is about 200 miles away from West Wego, and I have no idea what his current whereabouts are today. However, it seems to me that the best way to determine John's culpability would be to collect his DNA and compare it to the physical evidence. Even though there was no semen found at the murder scene, there was a sample of blood with a male DNA profile on the red wire used to strangle Crystal. We know it did not match Damon, but it would be interesting to see how it compared to John's DNA. Unlike with many other wrongful conviction cases, the Jefferson Parish District Attorney's Office said they would reopen the investigation into Crystal's murder following Damon's exoneration in 2012. Thankfully, they did not go the traditional route of maintaining they got the right killer all along and closing the case, but it's unclear how much investigation has actually been done. It's possible they did take a closer look into John Tomlinson and uncovered enough information to officially clear him as a suspect. But if not, I really wish investigators would re-interview him and take his DNA so we can finally put this matter to rest once and for all. While Tomlinson's discovery of Crystal's body is still incredibly suspicious, there are way too many unanswered questions to say with 100% certainty that he is the guilty party. Crystal may have simply been abducted by a random stranger with no personal connection to her, but if John can be conclusively ruled out as being the killer, we can move on to other leads. As it stands right now, it's hard to believe that we've recently passed the 20th anniversary of this crime and there are still no conclusive answers. Yes, Damon Thibodeau was technically exonerated, but his name will never be truly 100% cleared unless the real perpetrator of this crime is found. It's the least that can be done for Damon's legacy now that he's no longer with us, and of course, Crystal should not be forgotten either, as she deserves justice. So if you happen to have any information on the murder of Crystal Champagne, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, another special thanks to Anne King for narrating the opening of our episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the bizarre 1934 ransom kidnapping of June Robles, who was found alive inside a metal box in the desert, but her kidnappers were never caught, and there's been some debate about whether the whole thing might have been an elaborate hoax. I'm also going to be dropping the occasional exclusive bonus Patreon episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, and we recently released an episode in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the unsolved disappearance of convenience store clerk Deborah Poe. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are CCC, Renee F., and JJ. Thank you all so much for your support. And before we bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, Reverie True Crime.
I'm Paige, the host of Reverie True Crime. I tell stories of helpless victims, vicious killers, predators watching their prey before they strike, survivors, petty crimes, people we think we know who do the unthinkable, and the dangers that lurk not only in the dead of night, but in plain sight in the light of day. Every once in a while, I'll also tell stories of the frightening paranormal, elusive cryptids, haunted locations, and conspiracies that may be silly or thought-provoking. You can listen to Reverie True Crime wherever you're listening to this podcast. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at Reverie Crime Pod. Facebook, Instagram, and even Tumblr at Reverie True Crime. Remember, stay safe, be aware of your surroundings at all times, and take care.
I'm also pleased to announce that The Trail Went Cold has been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to get a discount. So to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. That's crimecon.com, and the promo code is TRAIL. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶